Good morning, and welcome to Family Life. Your hosts, Salima Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad is participating in Savior's Day events today, so she will join us again next week. And happy Savior's Day to all of those participating. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellence, Laurent Beach. Bismillah, Rahman, Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious and most merciful. I greet the listening audience in the peace of Assalamu Alaikum. This week's session is a continuation of a series, Keeping Up With Your Mental Health. Special guests, Youth Representative Samaya Muhammad, the daughter of the host, Salima Muhammad. Samaya's philosophy is sharing light with the world and finding comfort in oneself. Next, we have our distinguished guest and subject matter expert, Sister Rashida Rob Muhammad. Sister Rashida is the wife of our sponsor, Murad Muhammad. Sister Rashida, also known as Sister Sharon 5X Dunlap, we welcome her and we welcome Samaya. Sister Rashida, background. Rise, you mighty people. You can accomplish what you will. An avid reader and the love of research. In fact, a researcher of many subjects, specifically health and national and international affairs. Sister Rashida first heard the words, rise, you mighty people, you can accomplish what you will. When she was invited to a meeting and attended Mosque No. 25 in North New Jersey at the age of 21, and she said to herself, what has my grandmother and mother taught me since I was a little girl? That you are great and had excellent abilities. Thus joined the Nation of Islam was paramount and one of the best decisions she ever made as a young woman. Accomplishing what she could was profound to her, and she is forever grateful to the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his son, Imam Warfuddin Muhammad, Allah, for their teachings enabled her to succeed in many aspects of her personal life and working relationships with her employers. Study at Rutgers University in business management and a minor in accounting. She began her career both of the major newspaper in the city of North New Jersey as a circulation clerk at Bamberger's, now known as Macy's. She always loved a challenge and therefore started her path, her career path in finance. She now has over 13 years of international commercial loan experience, mainly in New York, Chase Manhattan Bank of New York. She supervised several staff members and loan administrators who assist with international loan officers. Her background incorporates Mid-Atlantic National Bank, and R. Ryko Corporation, West Caldwell, New Jersey, supply chain management, purchasing analysts, responsible for production analysis between vendors and suppliers. In fact, she was the first individual who worked with only analytical or analyst manual system. And this means she did not use an application, a purchasing application specifically. She did this with her mind, brothers and sisters. She was the administrative assistant to boxing promoter and entrepreneur Murad Muhammad of M&M Sports. We welcome both of you, Samaya and Sister Rashida. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Salamu Alaikum. Thank you for having me as a guest.
Lastly, we begin our discussion with depression and anxiety. This week's discussion is eating disorders, and we would like to note that this may be a sensitive subject matter for some. Eating disorders are mental illness which people experience severe disturbances and related thought emotions. Last week we talked about you are what you think. We're going to include you are what you eat in that idiom this week. Our focus today, anorexia nervosa and binge eating. And no, we are speaking from personal experience today. We advise anyone experiencing such symptoms to seek professional help. The National Eating Disorder phone number is 1-800-931-2237. And I will repeat this number again at the end of the show. Let us begin with anorexia nervosa, an illness where those suffering will starve, restrict, and avoid food in fear of weight gain. Some will engage in excessive exercise and or purging for the means of losing weight. Youth Representative Samaya Muhammad will provide a brief summary of her personal experience. Samaya, are you there? You may begin your story.
From when I was 15, the major key factor that triggered my disorder was the extreme pressures of society's beauty standards. A friend at the time made a comment about my appearance and talked about their preferred body weight in women. This made me feel like I had to change my outer appearance to appear more attractive to my peers. This was the beginning of a very dangerous illness. I started to restrict, starve, purge. It became my life. I stopped eating in front of my baggy clothes to hide my body. I avoided my favorite comfort food, and I even came up with a plan to avoid letting my parents find out that I was struggling. And to get more personal, like in high school, the parents could log in and find out what you were eating. So I would purposely buy food and just give it to a friend, but not eat, so that my parents could, you know, tell that I was eating, even though I wasn't. So that became, did that for like around a month or so. And it gotten so bad that my hair started to fall out. And it got really bad, like, it was just really hard to go through at the time because, you know, pressures of would look a certain way, and I felt like I had to be skinny in order to be as beautiful, and it really affected my personal life with friends, family. I became so obsessed with how I was looking and how I appeared, and it became so bad that I didn't really want to eat or go out or participate in any activities with my friends. I pretty much isolated myself. But no one really knew that I was struggling at the time. So.
Jemai, if I may, I recall specifically, you know, in you're speaking of this very candidly, and thank you, and you're very courageous. I so appreciate your sharing this, because it certainly will help others. The, you know, we can laugh now, right? But it's great, we can laugh now. But I want to pause here because, you know, as a parent, there were some behaviors, not specifically easily noticeable, the eating disorder, but some other behaviors, and we had you in counseling by the grace of Allah. That was just a total blessing, and this is how I found out. This is how your father and I found out. The counselor said, you know, Jemai's losing weight. I just thought you were looking good. I was like, hey, you know, she looks great. And the counselor said, you know, I need to speak to you and your husband about something. And she was the one who actually told us that you were calorie counting and what was alarming to her. And I was just so thankful to Almighty God Allah that she would listen, and that she was an observer, and that she was a true professional. Because one of the things she says, do you realize that Jemai is getting in less than 400 calories a day? And I was, that was a reality for your father and I. And you're right, we could log in, and we could see you eating, and I was like, oh my gosh, she's eating. In fact, I challenged therapist initially, so she's eating every day, and then we got to the story, and then you told us, I'm giving my food away. And I was like, what? You know, being oblivious to it all. Right here, right at this point, I would like to pause and bring in Sister Rashida.
Okay, I'm Salam Nathan. I'm listening and hating but understanding, because I have experienced that, not so much to the extent of purging or whatever, but the standard of beauty is placed upon an impressionable mind. And when that standard is placed before us, we try to live up to, again, that comes that real reality of the subconscious mind, that someone has put in place how I should look superficially instead of dealing with the reality of who I am. That happens to us even younger than 15.
Yeah.
Because you're looking at how you look. In my day, it was pleated skirt. And if we're a young girl, I had wide hips, so the pleats didn't lay flat like everybody else. So my mother would say, well, how come you don't have, I didn't like that because I didn't like the way I looked in it. But to myself, being self-conscious, and that's what happens, you become so self-conscious in trying to be comparable to those around you, so you kind of lose yourself. It also comes from I think, and this is purely from my listening to what you said, a lot of times within society, by us having had our culture taken from us, we are trying to live up to someone else's culture and someone else's appearance, which negated ours. And so by negating ours, we didn't feel beautiful in our own skin. We felt like we had to be, our hair wasn't long enough or wasn't straight enough, or your skin wasn't, then bleaching cream, and then back in high school, in my day, it was putting on a, some, it was like an elastic around the waist to have a waistline. And this exists today because you see the artificialness of our young women because someone set a standard for them. And today it's so out of control that once they take all of that false appearance off, they're going to be suffering from serious issues, not what you ingest. And when you're ingesting, you're robbing yourself not only psychologically, but from a nutrition aspect. Then comes the relationship between the gut and the brain. Because the brain is telling you one thing, but really you switched it and made the gut dictate to the brain. So that causes another sense and level of anxiety and depression. I'm speaking from self because at one point I was a little chubby, and then my brother would stand in the corner if I did something and say, Daddy. But I wasn't fat. I was just thick. But it still hurt me. And then I'm like, how did I look? How? And then when you go to high school and you see, you know, the guys and, you know, everybody's talking and whatnot, and, you know, the one who has the sweater and the coordinated outfit that looks perfect, and yours may not be perfect, or your gym suit. It's just a whole melange of a psychological vision, so you see, but your vision isn't actually seeing the reality of that, and you're not appreciating who you are because of these superficial things that have blinded you. And that's so consistent and persistent in everything from you can turn on your radio and you hear a voice, a sexy voice. And that's supposed to be the way you speak. But you can't speak like that in business environment.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not telling you that. You're thinking, oh, I should speak like that. And then you see the woman with the beautiful long hair and the Coca-Cola and sipping it. And, I mean, she's just fabulous. But no one knows that that has been designed to look like. It might not even be her. She might just be the model in it. But then they adjust her appearance. And now you could even do that online.
Yes.
So I think that whole situation comes to a point of our youth from the age of 8 or 9, because then you go into puberty, and then you go into your preteen, and then your teen. And what's not happening is that on a universal basis within our educational system, we're not really taught who we are. We're taught what we should be. Disenfranchise you from yourself.
You know, you bring up a good point, Sister Rashida. I want to pause you right there because this is imperative. I want to pause right there. Samaya, I'm going to jump over to you because, you know, this is important. And Sister Rashida, you raised your children Islamically, and I certainly, you know, raised Samaya Islamically, but I wanted her, you know, to have examples of the real life, because being raised in the Islamic system, I was kept from so much of the world. So you know, when we're released into the world, it was a whole other dynamic.
Absolutely.
However, Samaya, you know, and I want to say this to people of faith, no matter what your faith base is, you know, because sometimes I went inward and I said, my God, I didn't do the right job, or Samaya, this is where I want you to come in. I'm going to finish my comment and then we'll pick back up with Sister Rashida because she brings up a very important point. And we had standards and we had, you know, I dressed very Islamically as far as modesty is concerned. People knew you were of the Islamic faith. How did, and the last name Muhammad, that was also challenging. How did some of this play into your image of yourself? And how did you veer, if you can, away from the standards in the home to the standards of culture that Sister Rashida brought up? If you could make a small point regarding that, I think it would be extremely helpful for the listening audience.
Social media, you know, was the thing growing up. Like growing up, and I had access to YouTube and to Tumblr and Facebook. I, in terms of culture, you know, being raised Islamically, it was very challenging for me because my peers, you know, I felt like I was out of place. I felt like I didn't fit a mold. And, you know, being African-American also, it singled me out because, you know, my peers were, you know, had straight hair, blonde hair, blue eyes, that type of thing. And I felt like I didn't feel beautiful. So in terms of culture, YouTube was a way for me to discover new appearances, new clothing styles, and I felt like, you know, not fitting a mold. I felt like I should try to be more acceptable in other people's eyes. And growing up, I really just fell into whatever was mainstream and popular at the time. I didn't really have an identity of my own, really, up until adulthood, early adulthood.
Powerful. Sister Rashida, if you can chime in.
I can agree with what she's saying. Social media does have a vast array of addressing ills, whether superficially or in reality. But the whole issue, I think, is when we raise our girls, because we are half born. I have no knowledge of the female. I can only relate back to you. And I have three boys. So the transition or understanding, the transformation of understanding a male versus female, and that whole relationship is kind of challenging. But I can appreciate what she's saying in that I think that is also a very dynamic point that she made when you're in a community that's interracial, because my children were raised in the same environment. And the standards learned. And I think because it is more cosmopolitan where my children were raised, because it was a cul-de-sac that had multicultural people in it, versus that idealistic straight hair, blue eyes, narrow female, is very, very, very challenging. Very challenging. Because you're looking at yourself, and the superficialness of that is from an outer exterior beauty instead of a conscious beauty. And when you're in an Islamic home, your values are different than that on the outside. So you have that conflicting valuation of, okay, I know I have to be dressed modestly. And I know I'm not supposed to be overly aggressive. When you're out, the music's on. I mean, that's your natural tendency and behavior. I in no way say that. And I'm a full supporter of dancing. The whole world will explode. But yes, I assume that dancing also helps you let off a lot of your frustration. You can use it as an expressive mode to release those frustrations. But a lot of times when we hinder our behavior, and then use behaviors that are suggested, then the consciousness goes to a conflict. Then when you're looking at it, then you're saying, oh, I can't eat that. Oh, well, if I eat that, this will happen. And then the brain is saying, wait a minute, you're not feeding me. Yes, I know, but, and so that begins becoming your consciousness. Yes, I know, but. And that but becomes bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes overwhelming. That's when you say, that's when, whether it's beginning, middle, or end, the consciousness says you have a problem. And then within that, coming to that conclusion, you say to yourself, how am I going to do it? So when you became a young woman, my question to you is, what became your reality to overcome your anxiety?
I think this is kind of tricky. I didn't really start overcoming a lot of, the eating disorder part, like anorexia. That took, I would say, junior or senior year to fully get over. So roughly around 3 years. I really didn't become more conscious of my appearance in a healthy way until I turned, I would say, 20. So I think from my perspective, and I do want to note that a lot of this was done subconsciously rather than consciously.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because
I raised it. Mm-hmm.
Because when I started, like, at first it was just, like, the thoughts, like, oh, well, let me just skip out on this. And then, like, you do it so much that it just becomes routine, and you don't often think about it. And the effects of that is the illness continuing to start and, like, snowball until one day it becomes an avalanche, and then you're, like, stuck there, okay, well, what do I do now? Because oftentimes you don't know what triggered disorder in the first place.
And, Samaya, if I may speak, and Sister Rashida, I'm going to interject some things here that her father and I did subliminally. And, working with professionals. And, listen, it wasn't some scientific phenomena for me. It was, I'm going to save my daughter, period. And she was so funny. Well, we can laugh now. It was so funny because I noticed the environment and the culture that she was growing up in and how it was affecting her once it became apparent. So what we would do, we would integrate different cultures. And one of the things I know that we did, and I want to tie this into your international experience from a financial perspective and how significant this is, but first I want to explain how we would integrate. We would do it for fun. Samaya always had friends come to the house. I just felt better with the friends at the house rather than her going to someone else's home. She would, go to other people's homes, but the kids would mostly come to our home. And that was the foundation, you know, where we can observe. When she became a teenager, Sister Rashida, you mentioned the dancing, and we had this favorite restaurant called Club Istanbul. And she and her father, we would all dance together. Because I remember, listen, I remember the in the Nation of Islam having, you know, the bazaar, some type of event, and the old Muslims were dancing with the young Muslims. I remembered that, and I said, well, I have to integrate this some kind of way. And so we would have our friends, our Latina friends, our different friends from different backgrounds. We would salsa. We would go to Club Istanbul, and the brothers there were from Turkey. And we would introduce the international foods to the young ladies and the young men from the Maya social group, and we would dance. And we had so many wonderful, wonderful, wonderful life experiences there. And the brothers from Turkey would join some of their spouses and cousins and friends, and they would do their national dance, and everyone would join in. And it was just so phenomenal. So we started integrating the cultures and the international perspective and you know, growing up in America as a Muslim to her friends. And it really differenced. Because one of the things we had to start doing was having fun. You know, everything couldn't be serious. And so we started having fun, and that's what we would do. And it was so nice because they didn't have tables. I mean, they had tables if you wanted to reserve them, you know, for people who were disabled. But you sat on the floor, you sat on the pillows. And then the girls would belly dance. They learned how to belly dance.
Really?
And I remember, yes, and I remember my brother-in-law, after one Ramadan, invited the families after Ramadan. This is my sister's, and they resided there in Georgia with us. And they invited us to a similar restaurant in Atlanta. And the belly dancer would come around. Samaya was, oh, she was young then, maybe about 9 or 8, somewhere there. And the young lady went and selected one of the little garments, you know, that they wear for the belly dance, and they tied it around the children and they belly dance. And the brother was a Muslim, and he came around and he explained to how we would eat the foods. You know, you had different courses and how you would eat them. And with your hand, exactly. And we had the most wonderful experience. And when she became a teenager, my friend invited me out to the Club Istanbul, and it was run by a brother. We all became very close friends, and we miss it. So that's the only thing we miss of Georgia right about now, being able to go there. And we had such a fantastic time, Samaya. And then I think, you know, Samaya, you sang as a primary school student, but then high school, that became a saving grace. And she started singing opera. You started singing opera, gosh, I don't know, 10 or 11.
Really?
In high school, yes. And then in high school, she found her talent. And that is what brought her through. So if you could speak about that, she's still friends with her chorus friends. They are her friends today.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Speak about that for a few minutes.
So me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, chorus really did save my life, honestly. Because high school was really, really rough. You know, not only was I, you know, suffering from anorexia, but I also, you know, suffered heavily with depression and suicide. Like, I had suicide thoughts, and chorus was really the only thing that kept me motivated and kept me going. And without it, I genuinely do not know where I would be today. So chorus was like an escape for me. And I became friends with so many different people, different backgrounds. And, you know, it was a very humbling experience. And without my friends, I don't know what I would be. And so to those who are suffering from any mental illness right now, find that one hobby and passion that just really excites you and hold on to that. Like, you know, hold on to it. Like, even if that's the only thing that's keeping you alive right now, just hold on to it.
And I'd like to interject here that is found because that we find ourselves in no fault of our own. The impact upon our youth is astronomical because they're being put placed in an environment that is not part of their growth and development. So along with their own issues of evolving and growing, now you have something that's placed on, do not show expression, do not be close. And this is part of survival. That is why there's so, what did they say? They've had over 2 million parents call the helpline because of the depression and suicidal tendencies of their children to them.
Mm-hmm. 2 million.
Our 2 million, right? Yeah, I thought it was 2 million. 2 million call the helpline because of what they have to deal with their children having their expression masked, having their social norms totally changed. That nucleus of school is so important, whether it's adversarial relationship or not. It's part of that social product that is part of your development and your evolving and dealing with the next human being and yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that is told to them that, listen, And you can't tell them, we don't know what tomorrow's promised to you. For a child, that's like a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
What are you saying?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
if you tell that child, what do you like to do? You know, as a psychiatrist or a parent or whatever, I know I would have to do this if I had young children or grandchildren with me. I would say, and I do this with my grandson, my son insists and make sure he gets to his basketball practice because his whole socializing has been totally obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
So he can make sure he stays in the team and he takes them and brings them, make sure he has his little credit card so he gets something to eat and, you know, he can call or Uber or something. You have no choice if you're fortunate enough to do that. But when you think about those who don't have the ability to do that are really suffering. And there has to be some form of conveyance of hold on to this as
mm-hmm.
your lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's
ma'am.
Your lifeline. We want to tell them, if you're going to be the next Jeff Bezos or the next insane Bill Gates, And you're going to be on top of your... No. The reality of today is hold on to this for your survival, for your thoughts, and have that context where they are able to talk. Because when a child can't talk or express themselves to their parents, and this is the best time for a parent to establish an in-depth, intense relationship with their child and talk.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hide things from them. Because we in our hearts think, I don't know what the heck is going to go on tomorrow, but I hope my tomorrow is inclusive where they have a tomorrow.
Yes, yes. Very important.
We're on the short end of the stick. they're on the long end of the stick. And if they don't have a reality that will help assist in them not feeling overwhelmed or alone or disassociating, and only medium is a visual one on a piece of equipment, that's scary.
Beautifully. When what? So, yeah, I just want to pause here for a minute. Listening audience, this show is brought to you by New Africa Excellent. Rod speaks. Sister Rashida, you bring up such, oh my gosh, a phenomenal point. And when you do this, I need to pause you because I want to emphasize what you just said. And this was their measuring stick. It's not identifiable. It's longer. It's abstract, if I may. And they don't know where to grasp, to mold, to formulate. For them, it becomes a consciousness of beginning and end. And make no mistakes, brothers and sisters, Samaya excelled academically. And Samaya, to this day, by the grace of Allah, I don't even know how you did it, but this is what I want to ask you. Because we decided to go in high school, we decided to go the honor route. So each year you would take X amount of honor courses, and then you won a special award because you're a scientist too, and you won a special award in physics, and your educators were just phenomenal. So to this day, I know it's by the grace of Allah, but if you can give me some verbiage, how in the world you were going through all of this, did you maintain academic excellence? Could you please tell me how you did that?
Honestly, it is by the grace of Allah. because I don't even know how I did it, because it was a lot. My mind was a lot occupied by, outside things related, not related to school. But I think my main motivation was to graduate, to have an education, to want to do something with my life. And I think that was the main focus and motivation to, keep going academic-wise. And it was a lot because I, struggled with math in particular. And it was really hard to keep up with math, then also keep up with my mental health, and then also keep up with the friends, and then also keep up with, what was popular at the time. And it's hard to juggle everything, honestly. But I think counseling, therapy, and, talking to you guys about my struggles is what really saved me from everything, basically. And it kept me focused towards my goal of just graduating.
All praise due to us. Sister Rashida, if you can chime in.
Again, as we evolve as human beings, and in this case, our gender is female, we have so many challenges that we have to face, that we place on us naturally through our nature. Being able to grow and make decisions to keep your sanity is so important. Because the slightest, if you're weak, and we all have our weak, our physical and emotional weaknesses. But if you, like you said, I at the time, and I was weak in this, and this is what my main goal was, to complete it. And that's psychologically what propels us to evolve and do better. Because we're weighing that, and we're saying, oh, God, I know I can't do this, but I got to do that. And I know I'm going to do this, but the both of them together is to complete a goal, and you're accomplishing your goal. And that's what a lot of times our young adults and our teenagers don't have are given a focus goal instead of allowing them to acclimate to what they're best in.
Because
they're saying, we want to propel our children to what we see them do.
Yes. Yes.
Instead of working with them to help them point out what they want to do. And sometimes you say, well, you're not going to make it. And we, ours is, you're not going to make any money doing that. And you say, but I don't want to do that. I don't want to be this, but I don't want to be that. And that compromise is that, okay, well, you do a little of this and a little of that and see how you excel at. That flat-footed decision that, no, you're going to do this and it's going to be like my way or the highway, really, as that child grows, and I'm not saying this is yours, but taking into consideration circumstances and children around me and that I know and family and friends, they normally sometimes will do take your path, but once they have got to the end of that path, they go on their own path. Not the one that you set the goal for them, because then they become their self. They realize their self. And then they master and shape and mold that self to what they can live with. And sometimes the parent will say, well, I didn't do my best, and I didn't want that for you. But then you have to respect them for their wanting to be who they are. And then we have to accept that.
That's actually a really good point. Like, I want to bring up a point that from a younger perspective, the pressures to be our parents or be good enough for our parents, that is a real issue that can cause, trickle down with our mental health. It could put us in depression because we're hiding who we really are, because who we are might disappoint our parents, so we hide ourselves. And then, or the pressure to become a doctor for my parents versus I want it to be a musician is very, very common in a lot of younger people, and just people in general. They often feel like if they be who they truly are, they'll let their parents down. And that's really hard, it's really hard to, come to terms with, because you're battling your mind. It's like, well, I want to make my parents proud of me, but also being me is who I really want to be. But I'm afraid if my parents don't accept me for who I am, then they won't be happy, which won't make me happy. And that's just a constant mental battle as well.
And even in achieving those goals in this day and time, it's just so challenging and so difficult because of the work situation, of the prevailing grants and privileges versus lack of privileges, and the technology. And then you really have to begin to think, what are they really preparing me for in academia? What is this? Am I getting on a conveyor belt, a assembly line? So am I going to be the assembler, or am I going to be the product form? Or am I going to be the person who controls the assembly line and those who make the product? So it's like robotical. Because you're no longer looking at it from a humanistic viewpoint, and then it becomes material.
Yes, very much so.
So it's just, when you're young, it's confusing, but then you bring on all of the other anxieties that go along with school. Do you want a family? Am I going to excel at my job?
Yeah.
Just all... All of those. Yes.
Yes, ma'am. You're on point on
that
all
is.
Of the points. Yes, ma'am. And I think, you know, evolving, you know, somebody could tell us she wants to do something 10 different times, and now we're like, okay, girl, whatever you want.
Yeah.
But that took a while. Especially coming from my upbringing, you know, Hadia El-Amin Muhammad is Dallas Alex. Lord have mercy. Let me tell you something. She was very opinionated and adamant, and, you know, this is what you're going to be able to survive. And, you know, I think, you know, it came up in some of the, you know, points, Samaya, that we discussed. You told me I was rather overbearing at times.
Yes, you were.
Please feel free to discuss that. I'm very transparent. I have learned from my ways. And it goes back to what Sister Rashida said. You know, you have these, and it's really where implicit bias develops from, you know, our own cultures within our own communities and, you know, where our parents came from or the great-grandparents came from slavery and where you should be and what you should attain and how you should interpret all of that. But go ahead, Samaya. You can speak of how overbearing I was. Your daddy, not so much. I mean, he had his probably the overbearing one. Would you say that?
Yeah, I agree. You were just mainly overbearing with, you know, your expectations of academic-wise of, like, you know, you need to, like, get A's or B's, you need to pass. And, you know, I was scared because, like, when I failed a test or failed a class, I was scared to bring it up because I didn't want you to get mad at me for it. But eventually I knew, you know, found out that you just wanted me, you just wanted the best for me and wanted me to succeed in my education. But at the time, it was very, you know, challenging for me. It was more so like the pressure and anxiety of wanting to pass and be successful. And it was very, you know, interesting.
And then how was the pressure, when you did it homeschool, you know, which was, oh, my gosh, that was an experience for itself.
I forgot about that.
Yes, because you started, literally, she would start at 7 o'clock in the morning and finish 9 o'clock at night. And she had straight A's. And then your transition, you know, from straight A's to just, you know, struggling with different, you know, topic matters and going from that transition. Did you feel like you let yourself down, you know, when you had those challenges? Because it was almost as if, okay, you can't get a bad grade, forbid it there. And then I had to come into forms of reality. And your father really helped me with that. Coming into forms of reality, she's doing her best at this point. You need to recognize that. Would you say that was to another pressure point, you know, getting straight A's
yes.
And then, okay, yes. If you can explain that just a little.
So, school environment, can I, you know, people, a lot of people can relate to this now because of COVID. But homeschooling for me was very challenging because it was going at my own pace. And at first, I was doing great. Once high school hit in homeschooling, I began to lose footing of my pacing because, you know, that's when the depression starts to kick in and stuff like that. And the pressure of keeping those A's was extreme. Like, I felt like I had to keep pushing out straight A's in order to be good at something, like, good enough, you know. Once I started struggling a lot and failing to keep up with the pace of the school and the schoolwork and not being able to make it up even during winter breaks or spring break, it became very hard on myself, and I felt like, you know, I wasn't good enough. And then you know, when you needed to keep having straight A's, that just added extra pressure.
And then we figured it all out. And, you know, another thing that's happening, you know, with the pandemic, you know, online schooling is much more difficult than in person in this respect. They give 10 times, and I'm not being facetious, 10 times more assignments, you know, because they have to calculate those assignments into live attendance, you know, seated attendance. And it was explained to us, and we had a phenomenal, your high school was so outstanding. We went to the high school, and I remember the principal saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. She's going to audit these classes, and specifically so that she could get her footing. You know, he said, so she's going to get no grade, and then the junior year, she's going to take this class again. And Lord have mercy, she took those classes. She excelled. She did so well. Well, what a blessing that was. This is what we're going to do. And I remember laughing, and his daughter, she said, this is why they pay me the big bucks. And he was so sensitive and had so much compassion. And the educators in the high school were just outstanding, and that was a blessing, you know, coming from that online environment. And I know, because I was an online PhD student, and the work was just insurmountable. And although I was there physically, sometimes I wasn't there, you know, because I was in my own world, so to speak. Samaya, if you can read the stats right quick, because Sister Rashida started by saying 2 million parents, you know, are calling into national hotlines to get help with their children. If you can read the stats right quick on those who suffer with eating disorders.
Okay. Before I go into the stats, I just want to say, like, anyone of any background, no matter your gender, sexuality, color, race, we all experience it at some point. So in African-American teenagers, more than 60% are more likely than white teenagers to exhibit bulimic behavior, such as binging and purging. Hispanics were significantly more likely to suffer from bulimia nervosa than their non-Hispanic peers. Asian, African-American, Hispanic, and Caucasian youth all reported attempting to lose weight at similar rates, while among Native American adolescents, 48% attempted weight loss. People of color self-acknowledged eating disorder, eating and weight concerns were significantly less likely than white participants to have been asked by a doctor about eating disorder symptoms. So basically, people who are of color weren't really asked about, you know, by a doctor about eating disorder. So it brings up the point of, like, how us people of color are perceived in the medical field. We don't know that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. The medical field has a tendency, first of all, their whole mental outlook is 1-5-6-4.
Yes, very much so.
So I don't care if you're a tree person coming in, and complain about your branches, you're going to get the same thing that the person who has an illness with his arm is going to get. But you're a tree with a branch. So when it comes to us, that sensitivity is so much more intense, because I'm not saying all doctors, and I'm not saying all the profession, but a lot of them still have their subconscious prejudices. And a lot of them are foreign.
Mm-hmm.
And this understanding and could more or less do what is a prognosis or diagnosis? Diagnosis.
Yeah.
Based upon questions that relate with nutrition. That's why they don't, a doctor very rarely will ask you about your diet. Now, if you say, well, I have high blood pressure, well, you can't eat this, you can't eat that, you can't. But they don't tell you where it comes from and all of the mitigating circumstances that will keep your pressure high besides that food.
Mm-hmm.
So doctors aren't trained in nutrition.
They are.
And they're really not going to tell a child. They're going to deal with the child's parent, because they're not going to have that one-on-one with that child. He's going to ask all the questions to the parent, and maybe a yes or no from the younger patient, from the child.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand that would be even more acute in our community.
Yes, and, you know, Samaya, that's another portion I wanted to mention. We were just blessed. We had such phenomenal pediatricians, and they would speak to her. They would speak to her first, and they made her feel as if she was a part of her healing. And they were just phenomenal. We were blessed. Samaya, last week we discussed, you know, men specifically, we discussed men should be strong, aggressive, and fearless in a gender stereotype that is thousands of years old.
Yes.
You mentioned the different ethnic backgrounds. How does this disease or this illness affect men specifically with regard to eating disorders?
Okay, in men, over 10 million... males are affected at some point in their lives due to a large cultural bias that they're less likely to be seen for treatment for eating disorders. And a lot of times, you know, men, they don't even realize that they develop an eating disorder because society, you know, deems them as strong and they have to act and behave a certain way. So we talked about last week that, you know, a lot of men suppress their feelings. Depression can actually direct itself to eating and their body image and how they're perceived as, you know, who they identify as.
To Rashida, the importance of that nutrition.
Nutrition aspect still goes back to the gut and the brain relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And the necessity of the brain to dictate what should be consumed for the betterment of the whole,
whole
body, all the organs, all of this, all of that. But when you're looking at a diet that says, okay, I can have a burger and a pizza and a drink every day for lunch. And then the child doesn't want to take lunch to school that's properly made because he's going to be made fun of. My children suffered from that. My boys, when I used to send them to school, one of my sons liked, and I know this sounds terrible, but he liked turkey bologna on raisin bread with butter. And he would not eat anything unless he had that for lunch. And he would get into disputes with the kids around him because, oh, you, that's all you eat, da 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 da. But that's what he liked, because I would not let him eat school food, the cafeteria food.
Mm-hmm.
So when that nutrition comes up and you have that, you know, you're working parents. So you're going to see things that you're not there 90% of the time when they eat breakfast. And normally breakfast is sugar, a poison right there. And then you go to school, you're still not getting anything green because you have a choice. And you could go in and say, I want this, I want this, I want that. And it doesn't include the salad. I guarantee you. I don't have children in school, but I guarantee you if you said I had salad and make your own salad, and then you had the chicken fingers and the pizza and the drinks on this side, I bet you you'd be taking that salad buffet and giving it to the homeless. Because they don't, you don't see that because it's going to taste. So that's the question when you say you're still saying to yourself, "I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to eat that." And then that anxiety says, oh, "I'm going to gain two pounds if I eat that." And the body turns that you're injecting yourself with toxins in addition to not eating. Because you're looking at that food that's a source of nutrition as a source of something that's going to make you ill.
Yeah.
And you're feeding that illness, but you're also increasing the toxicity mentally of not eating from a perspective to sustain yourself. Your discipline goes out the window. Because you're not really eating and you're not evolving being taught or trained to eat in a school environment, something that's basically nutritional because you want the kids to eat and you want to get the money for the food for the cafeteria. So it's a hand, it's a handshake. But if it was a thing that we kind of taught our children, if you don't have the ability and the parents in the home who have the knowledge to do that should start in preschool.
Sister Rashida, you have
preschool.
Yes, ma'am, that early. You speak of a real reality and how language make people.
Oh, word.
When you start in preschool, And Samaya, I have to chuckle because we started that early, so we gave her the foundation. But Samaya does not like celery today.
Oh, no.
Because I chew so much, in her younger years, the carrot juice, the celery, the beets, everything. And we started that young, and, she never had a weight problem growing up, but then when society pressure started coming in, that began to alter. Sister Rashida, what does that language change?
The linguists are very clever with language and the feasibility of changing something, as Alka says, they make long, fair things. So if you deal appetite, you're dealing with taste.
Mm-hmm.
You're not dealing with substance. Mm-hmm. So let's just say, start with breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is a natural phenomenon for the female that is ordained and prescribed for the human to survive. That's part of your nature. So that's that, and it's so deep because it's a mother-child relationship. It's the mother providing immunity to the child. It's an emotional because you're holding it and it's touching you. Then they introduce the bottle and the nipple. Hard nipple, hard bottle. Then you begin to hold that bottle by yourself. Whereas normally you would be clasping the softness of the mother's breast. So as that child grows, then convenience makes food in a glass bottle, jar, rather than cooking it, mashing it, and giving it. Because that takes too much time because you got to work and you can't come home and do all of that. And then it evolves to the point that that taste becomes salt and sugar. If you're going to give a child juice, give them 1/4 juice and 3/4 water.
Mm-hmm.
It still has a taste, but it won't have that sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start them on eating fruits for snacks or raisins, mine was, my mother used to, for sugar, my mother used to give us dates. So I'm a date addict to this day. And it was dates or raisins, of course, fruit. And back in the day, peaches, you had to, and I'm telling how old I am, you had the vegetable man that used to come in the street and call out what he had on his wagon. And they were juicy and ran down your arm and sweet. And you grow, your child grows with that and relates back to that. But then comes that 10, 11, and 12, where the chips come in because your mother can't see you and you have 25 cents. And you don't get a bag of chips. So the chips come in and the soda come in. But you, the parent in itself can either have control over that to a certain extent or advise it of why you shouldn't have this. They're going to do it anyway. I'm going to tell you because my mother used to do it. And if I used to do little chores with my grandmother, this would get 10 cents to go get a bag of Bon Ton potato chips that I knew I had no business eating. And one of my siblings would probably go back and tell my mother anyway. But the control over that is so more easily done now because you have that preschool concept where you can introduce the fruit if you don't have that environment at home. And then you have to educate the parent. That has a lot to do with it. The parent isn't being educated, but the parent is being educated on the outside from what their parent taught them. So that re-educating the parent will actually enable the development of proper nutrition. There's no other way around that at this point. And if they continue what they're doing now, making people suffer from despair and desperation and lack of vision for their future, we really have to educate the young parents for survival, which means it might not be all that sugar and what. You may have to buy something, prepare it for a couple of days, and you'll probably get more out of that than if you bought a process that has all of the additives, preservatives, sugars, and you don't know where it came from. And it still has to deal with that nutrition and that understanding of what you're eating and why you're eating and why you can't eat that much and why we don't have that much. Because I can't imagine a child right now dealing with their parents being out of work and having to go to a food bank and get food. That has to be psychologically something that really is not really being addressed. Because we're just still being told just to wash our hands and distance and put your mask on and don't come out.
Yes.
So that
thank you.
That nutritional aspect of it right now, there should be some kind of public announcement or forums or even within the municipality on or put it in the mail or something like that on what you need to do to add nutrition and vitamins to meals instead of having empty non-nutritional meals that you're sticking in the microwave, it's going to peel whatever you're eating anyway. So that nutritional aspect is very important in instilling in a child at a very young age. Parents aren't of the level or educational level that they're practicing that in the home. They need to be part of the educational system also.
You know, and
not
I think
reaching out to our young parents.
Yes, I think it's Rashid, you bring up such a good point, and I want to bring in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad here, because when the language changed for our people in North America, it started telling us how to eat to live. It started changing that language for us. And Samaya, this is a part of mom's upbringing, how to eat to live and to do for self.
Right.
So that it doesn't depend, you're not dependent. So that's where the education comes in for me. And I don't know if I ever articulated it quite this way, Samaya, but I got it straight today. What your father and I were essentially trying to articulate is to, it doesn't matter. And that's where I come from. Who's in charge of what? To the degree that you feel as God's creation, and I think Donald Elijah Muhammad was trying to articulate and did articulate very well, to do for self, that your rights and privileges, you want education to the point where you know how to defend yourself, where you know how to protect yourself. And that is not going to be mainstream, because if it's mainstream, we have so many suicide rates, we have so many, you know, like you say, 10 million men affected by eating disorders, some form of mental illness. We have young people affected by mental illness because there hasn't been, there's been all these outliers controlling and participating and pulling their lives. There was a book written years ago by Carter G. Woodson. It was called The Miseducation of the Negro. Mm-hmm. Very good read, and really correlates to a lot of what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad brought to us. The book was originally published in 1933. And, of course, we know our leader and teacher brought this information to us as he cleaned us up, as he promoted us to start dignifying ourselves again, being clear about our focus, changing our language. So as a legacy, it's important to keep passing this on to our young people and making it not a stipulation, but an understanding of why it was done. For example, my great-grandfather purchased land. He had 12 children. He made sure each child, not the oldest, the middle, or the youngest, each child had 4 or 5 acres, whatever it was, equally apiece. Still standing today.
And that's important because it gives a legacy to the family.
Yes.
Of their existence.
Yes.
And
exactly. Mm-hmm. And my Aunt Ellie, my grandmother's older sister, she grew food. They called it a garden. it was a farm to me. Because Aunt Ellie had everything on that little garden. It wasn't a garden. Again, it was a farm. Yemisee, South Carolina is still standing today. And so it's important.
That's so important. Very important.
Yes. As we, you know, we have to bring the consciousness back to our young people of why they exist and what they survive. And Samaya, that's why I want to thank you for sharing something that I would not speak on because it was not my place to.
Mm-hmm.
A very challenging time in your life to help other people and to show what integration and love, and I may not know exactly what you're going through, but I'm about to find out because you have a job to do. You have a business in life. And more than anything, that's before me. I want to meet my grandchildren. I want them to have a legacy of purpose. So, Samaya, if you could talk about purpose and how important that is to young people for a few minutes, and then, Sister Rashida, if you can interject right after she's done.
Well, you know, it's purpose. I still struggle with this, so I may not be the best person to ask. But I do think it is important to find your purpose in life, whatever that may be. And, you know, it is challenging because, like, even now I'm thinking, well, like, okay, what purpose is that, you know? So, like, the younger people kind of will relate to that. It's hard to find a purpose because you don't, especially if you're just trying to survive in life. So it's kind of hard to find, you know, purpose, basically. But I do want to say whatever interest you have, you know, whatever excites you, discover that. Learn more about it. Learn education is important and outside of, like, you know, the requirements. Learn about the things that interest you and, you know, find your values, find your beliefs, find what matters to you and stick with that. And as you change and grow and evolve, your values, beliefs, and morals will morph into you as you grow and gain experience through life.
Well, I can agree with that too, and I also want to say that purpose also has a lot to do with understanding self. Understanding self, because of the fact that there's such a herd mentality of doing what everybody else does, that individual who stands alone has looked at as the obstacle and made it feel uncomfortable. So that's why I believe that purpose is very hard to set when you're young, because you have all of these cues around you.
Mm-hmm.
No, do this. No, do this. Oh, you got to do this. Oh, you don't do this. You got to do this. Oh, why did you do that? You should have done this. So your purpose always is in a state of contention because you haven't really come to know yourself. You're still in an evolving, growing stage. You go from stage to stage. So, yes, I agree. Point out a purpose. If you have other issues and cues and subliminals around you showing you what a purpose should be when it's artificial.
Mm.
You have a lot of artificial cues around you.
Mm.
And because we don't know the reality of real, then you're going to make decisions based upon, and you're going to be influenced by those subliminal cues that are around you.
Exactly.
And it's hard to, it's very difficult actually discuss this with a younger person, even adults, because if they're on the mindset that they know everything, they're not going to take the time to step back and listen.
Yes.
And a child will sure, this my son, tell me, well, Ma, that was back in the day. And how do you think I got to this point?
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that, you know, and well, that's the way you did it. No, if you stop and think about it, just see if I'm giving you any wisdom or you can use anything that I say. I know my son called me the other day because within that international lending, the loan officer took me underneath his wing and he taught me a lot of intricate things that normal people will not know about banking. And in doing that, we used to use, for some of the jewelry firms in the country, we used to use gold certificate collateral. And he held us up to me. He said, Sharon, this is not the best collateral. Looks good, gold inlaid, you know, the stamp and everything. He said, but I will tell you this. He who holds the gold rules. If you don't have that tangible asset, this means absolutely nothing. So in essence, what he's saying to me is that it has to be something of substance. But everybody has a different definition of what is substance. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's difficult for us, because I went through the same thing to point out a purpose. Until, again, when we were younger, we were able to go into the workforce at a much younger age than coming out of college. So you matured real fast because you had your little salary and you had to give your mother a couple of little dollars, probably left you enough for bus fare and maybe buy, you know, a few little things. But it still was training you to be responsible and understand your fixed expenses and yourself. But when you're going through trying to understand yourself, and then you go into another layer of education that delays that even further, then that decision on what do I really want to do, unless you have set a goal and you work towards that goal, your purpose is kind of multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
Did I make sense?
Yes, you made sense.
Thank you. That was so beautiful.
That was so beautiful.
When you're 20,
go ahead, please.
When you're 20, my beautiful niece and I were talking the other day, and she was saying that I have things that I want to do that my mother doesn't recognize and blah, blah, blah. And she's being very truthful about that. And I said, well, you have to really step back and say, where do I want to go from here? And understand from put your mind on envisioning. There's a path in front of you. Life's path is not straight.
Mm.
It has a lot of off roads that you have to take. And your objective is, if you go on one of those or several of those off roads, how am I going to get back to that path that's my goal? And that's what you really have to stop and think to yourself. So I'm saying this as a point of projecting purpose, is that life is a journey, and you have to understand those paths that you need to stay on that straight path. That's survival right there, because you know you've been given as the foundation, as the ground of your spirituality. So you're not commanded to do anything. It's prescribed to you. Just like medicine, you could take it or you could leave it. When you set that purpose, you will feel comfortable about it, and you know. And sometimes you're going to be off that path, but the journey is, the objective is to stay on that path so that you can realize that purpose.
Mm-hmm. That's very inspiring.
Isn't that very inspiring? Oh, my gosh. Sister Rashida, you have been such a contributor today. Final words, Sister Rashida, and then Samaya's final words, and then I'll give my final words. Sister Rashida, if you will lead us into that.
My final words is that The youth are our tomorrows, and they are our legacy, and they carry on the spirit of, and if we don't begin to understand that they need us, and they don't begin to understand that we need them. They need us and we need them, because we have to come to a point to put importance on their growing and being able to attain a sense of accomplishment. That's my closing. I think the youth are very important. Without them, we will be no more.
Very true.
They carry on our gene, our RNA, our DNA, our personalities, our characteristics, good, bad, or indifferent. But they are a reflection of us, and we need to support them mentally and spiritually.
Very beautiful, Sharon. My final words is, I said it last week and I'll say it again, you know, when you're struggling, it's okay not to be okay, as long as you don't give up. Keep pushing, keep trying, hold on to that one thing that gives you the strength, even if it's just your pet. Hold on, don't give up, and, you know, just please stay alive and work through your inner turmoil, and stay confident in who you are. Mm-hmm. Don't let society tell you that you're different or that you're not normal. You are normal. If you're alive, you're normal. You know, don't get caught up in comparing yourself to other people or to your friends or to your family. You are who you are. Don't change that.
I'm giving you
from the
mouth of babes.
Thank you.
From the mouth of babes.
Yes, ma'am. You know, I always like to share reads, and I think Rashida spoke and Samaya spoke quite poignantly about the road less traveled. And that is a phenomenal read. The Road Less Traveled is originally published in 1978 by M. Scott Peck. He's a medical doctor. And the reason why I chose this read at the end is because he speaks about, and I read this as I was trying to, and I chuckle, define my purpose, that I was in my 30s. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so, Samaya, that is a process, and it is a road less traveled, and you're just beginning, and I think Sister Rashida just...
I do want to say one more thing.
Sure.
Because, you know, this is something that's bringing at me today. I just want to say, like, you know, if you haven't heard it at all in all your life or recently, I'm proud of you. Thank you for being alive. Thank you for staying alive. And, you know, if, you know, hearing this saved your life, you know, I just want to thank you. That's all I had to say.
That's how beautiful. Thank you. It's very much needed. And that's why I want to speak about love and what that is. You know, love.
Yeah,
it has no gender. It has, you know, love is the healing. That's self-love. And that's what I want to emphasize first. Storing that self-love and begin with self, because, you know, we cannot extend this to anyone else if we don't extend it to ourselves first.
Mm-hmm.
The Creator has so much love for us. The path that is recommended is a path understood most for me, becoming a parent, is when I begin understanding the Creator. And I remember the day my daughter Samaya was born. The first person I wanted to speak to was my mother. And she had 9 children. I don't know how this woman dealt with 9 different personalities. She was a psychologist. She was a mom. She was a doctor. She was a mother. She was a friend. And near the end of her life, she couldn't say that many words, so she got the point off with phrases. And she said, live, love, laugh, and don't forget to dance. And I thought that was so powerful. Because a phrase maybe she borrowed from, and then she added her own. She said, don't forget to dance. I want you all to be happy. That comes from within. Mm-hmm. And I thank both of you for sharing in your humbleness, passion that you've brought to this conversation today, Samaya and Sister Rashida. We're going to continue next week with Sister Rashida specifically. Dr. Muhammad will be joining us. The Sister Rashida is going to discuss specific things, and one of the things she's going to talk about is prepping for program. And Sister Rashida, I think that's so ideal in continuing these series. How do we do this? And I thank you for sharing that so much with the listening audience and Samaya on purpose and then validating how she felt. You're validating how do you feel. You're validating your own personal experiences, Sister Rashida. Thank you so much. Samaya, you're validating the existence. And thank you for so much being here today as our youth representative. We look forward to having you in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Both of you, if you can give your contact information, Sister Rashida, if you can, if anyone wants to reach out, is there a best way for them to do that? If so, what is that contact information? Sister Rashida, can you hear us?
I don't think so.
Okay, so we may have... I lost her. Okay, Samaya, you can give your information.
Okay. Okay. My email is hippiechick, hippiechick15@att.net.
Yes. And don't worry, brothers and sisters, she will be back with us next week. My information, if you need to reach out, Salima, SalimaH. MOH77@gmail.com. And I also want to provide that number again for the National Eating Disorder phone number, and they can give you information on how to contact someone locally. That number is 1-800-931-2237. Again, that number is 1-800-931-2237. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent. Mirad Speaks. Thank you for joining us today. Have a blessed day. And we'll see you next week. Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.